This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple. Welcome back, everybody, and Happy New Year to you. Tonight's program features two poets. The first is Alicia Ostriker. Ostriker is one of America's premier visionary poets and critics. She is the author of 14 collections of poetry and is the recipient of the Patterson Poetry Prize, the William Carlos Williams Award, the San Francisco State Poetry Center Award, and the National Jewish Book Award. She has twice been a finalist for the National Book Award. In July of 2012, I had the great pleasure of hosting Ostriker at the Word Temple Poetry Series in Sebastopol. She read from her latest collection that night, The Book of Life, Selected Jewish Poems, 1979 to 2011. I recorded the reading and will play most of it tonight. You do not need to be Jewish to appreciate the woman's work. It is incredible. I think you just need to be a feeling human being. Following the reading by Alicia Ostriker, Marin County poet Gerald Fleming turns the tables on me and interviews me regarding my new book of poems, Cloudfire, published by Spuyten Duyvil Press in New York City in 2012. But first, it gives me great pleasure to present Alicia Ostriker.
Thank you, Catherine. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for being indoors with me on this beautiful evening. We probably should all be cavorting around somewhere. So the book I'm going to read from is called The Book of Life, Selected Jewish Poems, 1979 to 2011. And these are poems written over a course of 30 years. It's a diaspora of poems taken from 8 books, which I hope will speak to one another and to you. First section of the book is family poems, and it begins with the immigrant generation. And myself as a young girl. Becky and Benny in Far Rockaway. Near the Atlantic Ocean, past the last subway station, streaks of sand on the sidewalk, armies of aging Jews soaking up sun as if it were Talmud, and the rickety white stairs to an apartment like a frail body. My uncle and aunt were both warty, like alligators. They set a lunch on the oilcloth-covered table. I felt peculiar about the smells. The lunch seemed to go on all afternoon, anxious syllables floating over my head like fireflies. Shana Madel was me. Eat, they said in English, eat. This is what they do, right? They say, eat. So I ate and finally reached the pastoral scene, Bo Peep, pink roses, green leaves at the dish bottom. One of those sweet, impossible memories Jews used to buy themselves in America. The two of them beamed, gold-toothed, as if their exile were canceled. You should eat and be healthy, they said. And this is another New York poem, Born in the USA. Bruce Springsteen stole the title from me. Born in 1937 in the USA, not yet a war year, though war was coming, along with its patent leather and bow-tied photographers. When I say I feel like a rusty Dodge, I reveal my age, my brand, in an age of brands. Here I am, that Depression-era child whose father took her yearly to Coney Island where we ate Nathan's Frankfurters, whirled madly in cars of remarkable lacquers, stood with the crowd, sighed at the fireworks. At the end, an American flag gleamed over the ocean, telling us it was time to head for the subways. Damp sand blowing across the boardwalk, linoleum stained with juices, and an oilcloth table at home where we beat time and sang, "Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union." For we believed a better world was coming. Such and such, my sources and my spring, for which I sink to my knees in gratitude, and dare you, my fellow citizens, in the nation of money, I dare you to mock me. This next poem I'd like to read for you is an elegy, elegy for Allen, that is to say, Allen Ginsberg, who ought to be immediately recognizable by his first name. That was a break in the fiber of things sorrowful when Ginsberg died. Because I still have students wanting to be Beats, and even some wanting to be Buddhists, why not? But when that brilliant Jew poet took the train for the next world, American Nirvana temporarily went with him. Not that he ever attained the tranquility supposedly sought. He was so nervous and somehow ailing. The neurotic, utopian, prophetic, fairy side of the guy never surrendered really to those Asian things. And too much ginseng makes a man feeble-like. Yes, B says, you would be there at a party, and he'd say, "Excuse me, I have to follow that young man." You'd think, fine, but why are you obliged to announce it? Why not just do it? The greatest Jewish poet, after Ceylon and Amichai, I cry, grieving, and B says, better not try to sell him as a rabbi. Though what else is he, for heaven's sake? Beads and bells and dreams of peace and all. I have to say, Alan hated it when I wrote about him as a Jew. But what else was he? I've been finding myself writing increasingly about mortality. And this poem is called At the Revelation Restaurant. Ecclesiastes sits across the table. And whenever I start to whine, he starts to laugh. Sometimes so heartily and suddenly that he spills his soup. Buddha, the waiter, looks sympathetic. Then I read the fine print on his enlightenment special. Reject birth, get off the wheel. But Mama Gaia flounces from the kitchen, exclaiming, must we despise our bodies just because the philosophers and pharmaceuticals, the priests and politicians, the advertising industry and the movie industry tell us to? So I whisper, Mama, I like my body. Washing and touching itself in the bath was the beginning, so sweet. Then dancing and kissing, too late to stop now. Since I know my eyeballs and clitoris will turn to muck or dust, as the preacher reminds me, And the process of dying, in all probability, will be extremely painful. Mama, tonight I intend to order the soup, the salad, the entree, the dessert. Now let's go to the dark side. And you can't be a Jewish poet and not write about the Holocaust. This poem is called The Eighth and Thirteenth, and it's based on the Eighth and Thirteenth Symphonies of Shostakovich. His Eighth Symphony is the Leningrad Symphony. So many of you probably know all this. The Leningrad Symphony, written after the siege of Leningrad during World War II, by the end of which 3 million Russians had died of one thing or another. The 13th Symphony is the Babi Yar Symphony, which is dedicated to the massacred dead of Kiev, the massacred Jews of Kiev. And I honor and revere Shostakovich, not just because he was a genius, but a particular kind of genius who was able to write a wrenchingly painful work of music grieving for his fellow Russians, and also write a wrenchingly powerful symphony on behalf of the despised Jews of Russia. And I think that's what God gives us imagination for, to be able to cross over to the other. The Eighth and Thirteenth. The Eighth of Shostakovich, music about the worst horror history offers. They played on public radio again last night. In solitude, I sipped my wine. I drank that somber symphony to the vile lees. The composer draws out the minor thirds. The brass tumbles overhead like virgin logs felled from their forest, washing down river and the rivermen at song. Like ravens who know when meat is in the offing, oboes form a ring, an avalanche of iron violins. At Leningrad, during the years of siege, between bombardment, hunger, and three sub-freezing winters, 3 million dead were born out of Christ's bloody side, like icy fetuses. For months, one could not bury them. The earth and they alike were adamant. The dead were stacked like sticks until maize mud, when, of course, there was pestilence. But the music continues. It has no other choice. Peer in as far as you like, it stays exactly as bleak as now. The composer opens his notebook. Tyrants like to present themselves as patrons of the arts. That's a well-known fact. But tyrants understand nothing about art. Why? Because tyranny is a perversion, and a tyrant is a pervert. He is attracted by the chance to crush people, to mock them, stepping over corpses. And so, having satisfied his perverted desires, the man becomes a leader. And now the perversions continue, because power has to be defended against madmen like yourself. For even if there are no such enemies, you have to invent them, because otherwise you can't flex your muscles completely. You can't oppress the people completely, making the blood spurt. And without that, what pleasure is there in power? Close quote. The composer looks out the door of his dasha. It's April. He watches farm children at play. He forgets nothing. For the 13th, I slip its cassette into my car radio. They made Kiev's Jews undress after a march to the suburb, shot the hesitant quickly, battered some of the lame, and screamed at everyone. Valises were taken, would not be needed, packed so abruptly, tied with such frayed rope. Soldiers next killed a few more. The living ones, penises of the men like infant mice, breasts of the women bobbling as at athletics, were told to run through a copse to where, wet with saliva, the ravine opened her mouth. Marksmen shot the remainder, then, there, by the tens of thousands, cleverly, so that bodies toppled in without lugging. An officer strode upon the dead, shot what stirred. How it would feel, such uneasy footing, even wearing boots that caressed one's calves, leather and lamb's wool, the soles thick rubber. Such the music's patient inquiry. What then is the essence of reality, of the good? The mind's fuse sputters, the heart aborts, it smells like wet ashes, the hands lift to cover their eyes. Only the music continues. We'll try, for the first movement, a full chorus, the immediate reverse of Beethoven, an axe between the shoulder blades of Herr Wagner. Quote, people knew about Babi Yar before Yevtushenko's poem, but they were silent. And when they read the poem, the silence was broken. Art destroys silence. I know that many will not agree with me and will point out other, more noble aims of art. They'll talk about beauty, grace, and other high qualities. But you won't catch me with that bait. I'm like Sobakevich in Dead Souls. You can sugarcoat a toad, and I still won't put it in my mouth. Most of my symphonies are tombstones, said Shostakovich. Poets are Jews, said Tsvetaeva. The words never again, clashing against the words again and again. That music. And another thing one does as a Jew is wrestle with God. My relation with my tradition has always been like that of Jacob wrestling the angel. And I've done a lot of work with the Bible, that great, wonderful, inescapable set of Ur texts, deeply patriarchal as it is, deeply patriarchal as the God is, and the patriarchs and the prophets and the kings and so forth and so on, all those heroes, as well as all those wise men who have until recently interpreted the Bible. Nowadays, women are getting into the act. And one of the things I have done since childhood, having been raised an atheist and having to rebel against one's parents, is I seek God. But I'm also never satisfied. This is called Psalm. I am not lyric anymore. I will not play the harp for your pleasure. I will not make a joyful noise to you, neither will I lament. For I know you drink lamentation too, like wine. So I dully repeat, you hurt me, I hate you. I pull my eyes away from the hills. I will not kill for you. I will never love you again, unless you ask me. Do not think I fail to remember. You were right there, clasping me, when we danced without words, commandments, fear. Oh, it was so good. Oh, it was like melting. Oh, it was like a rainbow. So where in hell are you now? You can tell I'm lonely. These are poems from near the opening of a book called The Volcano Sequence, which I basically channeled because the poems were telling me things I didn't want to hear. And so I knew I needed to hear them. And I made a conscious agreement, a deal with the poems, which was, if you agree to keep arriving, I agree not to tell you what to say. The book is called The Volcano Sequence, and I worked on it, or rather received it for a year. This next poem is called During the Bombing of Kosovo, and it depends on the Hebrew word hevel, which you will see translated at the beginning of the book of Ecclesiastes as vanity. You know, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. A great line and a mistranslation, because the word hevel in Hebrew actually means something like vapor or mist. So it's not quite an abstraction. It's almost an abstraction. And it has the sense of the ephemeral. Also, it is the name of Abel, as in Cain and Abel, the first man whose brother was not his keeper, during the bombing of Kosovo. Hevel may be translated vanity, or mist, or vapor. The name of the first man whose brother was not his keeper. It is evening, it is morning, one day, like mist, from 10,000 feet above the hills, bombs fall, like vapor. The thin air is full of them. Roads crawl with tanks, soldiers, like mist. Tens of thousands of refugees cross the border like vapor. From morning to dusk, unmanned families like mist. Women in slippers, children in bare feet like vapor. Carrying blankets, suitcases of clothes like mist. Money ripped off by border guards. Not new under the sun, not new on throbbing blue-lit screen. But the eye tires of seeing, the ear of hearing. Oh, we still prepare our feast of liberty and memory. We remain your children. And you, you, father of rain, what are you thinking? And then another figure announced itself, or rather herself, as the poems were going along, full of complaints. The term Shekhinah in Hebrew literally means presence, and whenever in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, you see the phrase "the presence of God," that's Shekhinah. The word means dwelling, and it refers to God when God is among us rather than exalted, distant, far above us. So Shekhinah refers to God with us. Because the noun is a feminine noun, over the centuries it morphed into a persona, the Shekhinah, as the feminine aspect of God, and there's all kinds of legend and lore about her, including the idea in Lurianic Kabbalah that at the moment of creation, which was catastrophic, an explosion, very like the Big Bang, as we know it today, in which spirituality could not be contained in its vessels and exploded and fell into matter, which is us. God and his Shekhinah were divided instead of being a single being. And the goal of history is to unite them. That's one whole set of stories. Another whole set has to do with the Shekhinah as traveling into, well, as no, she's there at the Western Wall in Jerusalem among the pigeons. That's another whole set of stories. And then another whole set in which she travels with her people into exile. So this is the Shekhinah as exile. Hidden One. When the temple fell, when Jerusalem arose and fell, and whenever we were persecuted and scattered by the nations to follow us in pain and exile, you folded wings, patched coats, survived working, praying, giving birth, dragged mattresses, pans in peasant carts, swam across hard seas, sick and homesick, landed in the Golden Land. They called you Greenhorn. You danced in cafes. You went in the factory, bargained, pushcart goods, ice, shoes, Hester Street, put makeup on, threw away wig, and you learned new languages. Now you speak everything, lady. But part of you is earth. Part of you is wounds. Part of you is words. And part is smoke. Because whoever was burned over there, you were burned. You died forever with the sheep. Whoever survived, you speak in our tongues. Open your wings, instruct us, say what we are. Do not confuse us with the Sanhedrin of the loudspeakers who have no ear for your voice. But we who thirst for your new instructions, source of life, come into our thoughts, our mouth. Speak to us, voice of the beloved. Help us say what we are, say what we are to do.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Alicia Ostricker, who will be reading just one more poem before we move on to the next segment of tonight's program.
This is a poem that remembers my most enjoyable day on a visit some years ago to Jerusalem, staying with my friend, Linda Zisquit, who's a poet and a wonderful translator. And the poem is called What is Needed After Food. And it's got an epigraph by Yehuda Amichai that says, "The darkness doesn't war against the light. It carries us forward to another light. In my land, called holy, they won't let eternity be. They've divided it into little religions, zoned it for God zones, broken it into fragments of history, sharp and wounding unto death. So this is the last poem I'd like to read this evening, and all you need to know about it is that it was written at a time when Arafat was still the mega leader of the Palestinians, and Sharon was still prime minister of Israel. Mirror images of each other, if I may say so. And so beautiful it cracks the bones, especially Jerusalem, with the luster of her stones, the hurt in her eyes, and our dreams for her children. A triangle, beauty, despair, hope, the whole mishpacha pulling three ways at the same time, like the people in so many families, fighting but joined at the hip. Or call it a sandwich, despair the filling embraced by the bread of beauty and hope, like a manna we eat every day, sent from above. While on earth in Jerusalem, my friend's husband and son relax from a Sabbath meal like well-fed beasts, happily slumped watching the aftermath of a game where the Nazareth team has just won and vaulted from the bottom of their league to the top. The players have stripped off their shirts, hugging and dancing, circle dancing, belly dancing, waving at crowds in the stands to make them cheer louder. The coach strips his shirt from his hairy barrel chest, climbs a wire fence, wobbles and waves his hips. When someone asks how he feels about his team, a mix of Jews, Muslims, and one Nigerian, he himself is Druze, he punches the air and roars, "I beat them all. I beat Arafat. I beat Sharon. I show them we love each other." We watch a while. The celebration is still going on when we quit to go back to the kitchen, where loaves of beauty and hope stand on the counter and the cup of despair goes on the shelf. My friend and I, we don't ask for much. We read Amichai. We're not messianic. We don't expect utopia, which is anyway another name for a smiling prison. But love is a good idea, we think. Why on earth not? Simple women that we are, simple mothers cleaning up the kitchen after one meal to make it ready for the next. Thank you.
You've been listening to Alicia Ostriker reading from The Book of Life, Selected Jewish Poems, 1979 to 2011. This was recorded at the Word Temple Poetry Series in July of 2012. And now this.
Welcome to Word Temple. If you are a regular listener of Word Temple and are expecting the dulcet tones of Catherine Hastings, do not despair. This is Jerry Fleming, a West Marin poet, and I'm part of a conspiracy to turn the tables on Catherine because she has a new book out, and she tonight will be the reader and interviewee. So welcome, Catherine, to your own show.
Thank you, Jerry. Okay.
Catherine's new book is called Cloudfire, and it's published by Spuyten Duyvil in New York City and just out this year. Although the poems in the book travel through different places, San Francisco, Marin, Sonoma County, and in one instance, Georgia, and although the poems in the book reveal many experiences and move through different times of life and emotions, love, loss, childhood trauma, etc., there's a constant presence of clouds and light running through the book. I wanted to read a little bit about what Gillian Connolly, the terrific writer and editor and professor at Sonoma State, said. She said, "How refreshing to come across a book like Catherine Hastings' marvelous Cloudfire, rich and verdant in formal experiment and range, mixing lyrics, narratives, curses, blessings, spells, and unabashed love poems. The work is hard-won and honest, generous, and rigorous." And she says even more than that, but I won't read the whole thing because we want to have more time for Catherine to read her own poems. I wanted to say a little something about the cover, Catherine. When I got the book, I was really impressed with the cover. It's a massive explosion of color, crepuscular color, we might call it, I think, reds and blues and greens and yellows. And I wanted to see where the image came from, and I flipped the book over, and I see that it's one of your paintings.
Right. Huh? The cover is a section from one of my paintings called Cloudfire. I wanted an image of the Golden Gate Bridge in fog, but I wanted the image to appear a little distorted, almost childlike.
I see. It sure does. And I wondered, is it oil or is it acrylic?
It's acrylic.
It's acrylic. Yeah. And is it a large painting or?
It's not that large. There it is hanging
on
the
wall.
There
it is on the wall. I see it. I wish our listeners could see it too. Yeah. Interesting. One of the first things that I do in a book is look at the epigraph, if there is an epigraph. And I think it gives you a little bit of a sense of what the book's going to be like, the gravity or lack of gravity or gravitas of, mm-hmm. of the epigraph. And the epigraph in Catherine's book is, "Fog knows what love isn't, an erasing of existence." So right away you read that epigraph and you know that you're getting into a book that is going to be something worth reading, at least
that's the way
I feel. Now, why clouds? It's called Cloudfire, the book.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, I grew up in San Francisco, and the home I grew up in was a dangerous place for a child.
Mm. That comes through in the book.
Yeah, it does in certain parts of it. Mm-hmm. So I spent a great deal of time outdoors. We lived near the bay, near the Golden Gate Bridge, mm-hmm. and that part of the city in particular became a real type of refuge for me. So even though I grew up in a city, it was a city with lots of nature, including that wonderful fog. It's in me. It will always be in me.
Yes.
And when I die, my ashes will go into the bay.
Okay, you've decided that, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I grew up in the avenues in San Francisco, and I know very well what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And also what fog does, aside from clouds. So the first section of the book is called Clouds, and it's a long piece. And I wondered if you might read a few from that first section.
Sure. Yeah, the first poem does run about 17 pages. Uh-huh. I'm not going to read that many, but I'll read a number of sections. Clouds. We begin by christening them, salt grains of sky rising rhythmically from the soft nursery of fog, moth-winged nebula, haloed pillar of snow, feather and float, pasture and jaw, infinitesimal starbirth times a million. They are poured milk we spoon and swallow, wear like skin. They polish our cheeks and stiffen our fingers. They rest on our tongues, and together we taste them gliding over the wide water, silver in foglight. We cannot fly, but nest ourselves in clouds. But for the slow voyaging mist, we feel naked. We do this like children or angels living on the ledges of waves and lips, downy wings so white they hum every color, bees rolling in a white rose. My city, whose hair is a cloud fire, whose dreams are tumbleweeds of mist, whose body is a ladder from barnacle to night star, whose mouth bears the fragrance of the white-flecked sea, whose tongue is of onyx and humming wires. My city, whose streams are rock doves and parrots, whose bright arm is a springboard for love and suicides, whose heart is filled with winsome flowering kisses, whose lap is a playground of canvas swings, whose ghost stands behind them, pushing them up from the silver portal of heaven into the silver portal of heaven. Clouds brush a language of shadow and light. Waves speak their own tongue of dissolution. spindly-legged birds rushing their ruffled edges, dip into the shore's sweet pockets and swallow. We walk along the back and forth of it all, sand dollars and wood, seaweed and jellies, heads down, measuring the exact breadth of every word. For a moment, our history of who is correct and who is right is stamped into the cool ground, and the wind we've walked through so many times, aslant, is more like a laying on of hands than wind. If there is anything more to be said, we don't know what it is. So we listen to the sea, to the clouds, to the bubbles that rise from the deep and burst the last word. It was always theirs anyway. Now and then, a cloud leaf placidly breaks from the cerulean flow of sky water. It lowers itself through tree limbs, reaches into the stark whiteness of your bones. Swept into the hollow of the moment, you feel far into that moist body adrift. A vision, wind-combed, waits at the edge of red horizon. A sea of echoes emanates from the intermittent moon, veil, moon. It means nothing if not the opening and closing of desire, as a flower formed of fog floats through, is gone, leaving only your conscience forever whirling in the breeze. On the road to Kirby Cove, blackbirds and ravens, sea wind everywhere. Dream light imaginings are sprung here. Wings lift at will, release the torture that tears as fire tears. After many years and many changes, I return and return to sea mist. Her lips on me, her touch, shimmer down my frame of flying forms, rainbow winged. Here is merriment, the leap at the gate where salt sponges up memories, ensphered, of the grieving girl, squeezes them out at the edge of the world, until like an exhalation, the world drops through altered wind, gathers all light that heals the wound. Beyond the blue bay day, the fertile field of moon-filled sleep, silver-beamed, will lie under the stars, as a flower lives, folded by night.
I don't know if anybody's ever written about clouds in the sky in this way. There are some images that just blow me away. Who is right is stamped into the cool ground, and the wind we've walked through so many times aslant is more like a laying on of hands than wind. Very lovely.
Thank you.
Also in the cloud section is a relatively short poem. Tell us about that form. And in fact, this particular poem is in Lewis Turco's The Book of Forms, a book of poetics.
That's right.
And other exciting things are happening about this poem that I hear.
Yeah, so I'll tell you about the form first, and then I'll tell you about the other exciting thing happening. But this is how Lewis Turco defines the breath double. And I should say that the poem is called SF Breath. The breath double is an odd French syllabic form consisting of three quatrains and a final couplet, making 14 lines. Unlike a sonnet, however, it has three rhymes, the first two appearing twice in the first three quatrains, all of which end with the third rhyme. There are also five unrhymed lines.
Okay.
So the other thing happening with this poem is that the author, which is actually two authors, Lise Lenimsky and Carol Goodman, are writing a series of novels under the name Lee Carroll. And one of the books in the trilogy, The Shape Stealer, will have SF Breath in it, and it's going to appear on the wall of a hotel in San Francisco.
No kidding. Yeah. Do you know which hotel?
Well, I know it's in the Marina District. That's all I know.
Oh, that's good. So
it's
where I
grew
up.
So yeah.
Good, so. Can you read it?
Sure. SF Breath. Sea fog, come through my gates of cabled gold, where nets once hung to catch any man who flew. They formed a club called Halfway to Hell. Cover me coldly with your blue-born breast. My thousand eyes will greet you as fairies do, many colored and feathered, The bell on the bay will sway over shadowed waves, announce your entrance with crystalline breath. I am your queen, waiting with skyward curves. My body arcs up for you over old treasure chests buried under black paved bones. I have been loved before, sometimes to death. Are my hills too high? My valleys too bold? Climb me, fill me, sea fog, where others fail.
The most sensual poem about fog ever, I think, including an homage to Thanatos. So,
there you go.
So, thank you for reading that. Catherine, the next section is called Field Song, and there's a poem in here partly about Lynn Lana Deer, who I think I knew from San Francisco State University, and there's an epigraph by Weldon Keyes, whose car was left at the Golden Gate Bridge, as you know.
That's right.
And I know that that's probably informing this poem. Why don't you read the poem, if you would?
Okay. Well, first of all, Lynn Lana Deer was a San Francisco poet. She is one of the women who founded the Women's Building. And unfortunately, she committed suicide by jumping off a cliff in San Francisco. The woman in this poem considers the Golden Gate Bridge. Lana Deer rampant. As from a distance, watch yourself disintegrate in foaming seas. Weldon Keyes. You are too near the bridge to have such hair. Hair a man would love to comb his fingers through. Lana Deer. Walking down the old familiar street, doorways reappear. Shoe repair, new soles, smell of polish and leather, where you sat in a chair, swinging bobby-socked feet. Lana Deer. Salvation waits on the corner of donut holes, six to a bag, and in Mr. Bay's barber chair, platinum bangs feathered on the floor. Lana Deer. The bridge, Lana Deer, and the sea, Lana Deer, and the dark morning hours chew through your brain, looking for innocence, lost, Lana Deer. And the stab in your heart, where the intersection of life and death is marked. Cool fingers of fog have been waiting all these years, Lana Deer, knowing one day you'd be theirs. You are too near the bridge to have such hair, so you'll cut it off, leave its stories behind. Or if they stay, whispering in the roots, you'll feel it pulled by the updraft of love you left behind. Wasted, unbelieved, Lana Deer, your hair will be the last of you to hit the sea, the city that saved you again and again, rising swiftly to still you to sleep.
Oh my goodness. Catherine and I talked a little bit before the show about how Lynn Lana Deer had beautiful, long, blonde hair, and it comes across so beautifully in this poem. What about reading Farewell Song from the same section?
All right. Farewell Song for the Ashes of Frank Decco. The wind traveled to my ear, leaf to leaf. It told the world, hush, here is grief. The trees stood as swaying ghosts, bough to bough. I lay upon their roots, damp green vow. Their braided fingers held me up for light. I slept outside their hollows, cruel ribbed night. In the morning there appeared, lest I run, quills of gold sensations, spears of sun, shining a naked ribbon, a prism found, more ravishing than death. Spring's reflective gown. Today, May, I will be a bird, red-eyed and free, to fly over the long body of water where waves blown and bare blend ash to silver, fling him into air.
In the poems you've read so far, there's a great variation of prosody, it seems to me, this last poem having some strong rhymes in it. I was listening to the radio today, and it's the 50th anniversary of the Zen Center in San Francisco.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And they were talking about beginner's mind and saying that in beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, and in the expert's mind, there are fewer possibilities. But it seems to me that in my own reading of this book, you really are obviously skilled, but maintaining somehow beginner's mind. How do you do that in your...
You know, I think I just do what the poem calls for. And there are forms in this book. There are sonnets, and there are all kinds of things, and there's free verse. But it's just what the poem wants. And when I think back to my childhood, one of my better memories is of having nursery rhymes read to me. And so I think I've kind of held on to that musical quality, and in some cases rhyme where it fits.
The music really does come through, and in fact there is a nursery rhyme, rather a dark nursery rhyme quality to a dirge that's a little later that I hope you'll read. How about something from the next section called Continent of Light? I'm hoping that you'll read the poem called Rats, because you and I have both written poems about rats. And
Rats, a poem of jealousy. The rats always arrived the same day the other woman walked through the door. As she kissed his cheek, his mouth, his lips, as he brushed his hand across her breasts, the rats scurried madly across the floor. The rats followed them to bed, their tiny front paws with their needle-like claws propped up on the edge. Their eyes were onyx teardrops. Their sharp teeth chewed and chewed until the bed was gone, the floor was gone, the whole room falling through, crashing, breaking into splinters. The rats lay exhausted around the jagged edges, their filthy bodies spelling love.
Oh, my goodness. That poem has a fabulous quality, but it is not for children.
No, it definitely is not. It is not.
So good. Twister, huh?
Yeah. I grew up in California. I've lived here all my life, except for a 2-year period where my partner and I moved to Georgia. And this is maybe the one good thing that came out of that experience. Twister. Our new home was enormous on its Georgia plot, where bugs bigger than peach pits dropped out of trees to land on our dresses, and the clay still smacked of blood and we shall rise again. In winter, cardinals perched in fruitless pears as the cake-toting curious inquired in minor chords, not our names, but first where we're from, and second, just which church we attend. Come summer, downpour soaked the yards in white-capped waves, 5 hours from the sea, and I learned to drop the phone when thunder clapped, the windows flooding with alternating light and dark. Once we heard a train roaring down our trackless road. It elevated and twisted, not bending the trees, but snapping them at an even 7 feet. We couldn't see any of this crammed into the bunker of the half-bath beneath the stairs, clinging to news like kudzu, the matter-of-fact tone on our battery-operated radio flattening everything between the whining and whistling of the cracking, crashing world into a flapping map of road winding through Tennessee, ending back in California, where we drove all packed through lolling, parched, and burnished hills, basking in the breathless sun. Cows lumbering a slow migration to pools of oak-leafed shade, horses in the plain dozing to highway hum, not even a fly to shoo, the only roar more, a whisper of plane soaring over the hay-sweet vista, its vapor trail anchored in a clear blue prophecy. Earthquake weather.
Yes. That poem has such energy, and it's so visual and so sonic. It's just amazing.
Tornadoes have a lot of energy.
And you've got it. You really
And
did.
You know, about 2 months or so after we moved back here, I got a telephone call from a neighbor in Atlanta saying, "Catherine, I hate to tell you this, but this morning at 10 o'clock, lightning struck your old house across the street, and in under an hour, it was burned to the ground."
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
So it's like, hallelujah, welcome home.
Oh, gee. Catherine, there's a section in this book called She, not spelled S-H-E, but the Gaelic S-I-D-H-E. And I'm hoping that not only will you read a couple of poems from She, but that you'll introduce it and explain where you're coming from, and maybe the Gaelic tradition, the Gaelic mythology involved in it, for those of us who aren't familiar with that.
Okay, well, She is spelled S-I-D-H-E, means a people of the hills. It's the Gaelic name for fairies. and descended from people defeated in war, the Xi retreated to a different dimension of space and time. They have the power to move quickly through air and change their shape at will. The Xi live under mounds, and in this poem, which is too long to read, the Xi live in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So I think what I'll do is...
He didn't like the Virginal or Oshid of Greenwich Street.
Okay, I'll read Oshid of Greenwich Street.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah. Oshid of Greenwich Street. 2182 is the color of dirty Caucasian flesh. Squint your eyes. Dead doves of tissue float from the landlord's room, rest on heads of passing schoolgirls. Rocking to and fro, he whistles one long strain. Phantom train in the night, long-forgotten teapot. He giggles like a girl. 2182, stairs burrow under to the dirt-walled cellar, where the mortal man, the stepman, mounts the whimpering stairs. Hair wrapped around fist, feet dangling down the hall, a garbage sack of a Xi is tossed, door slammed shut. She'd been off the block again, was missing, was found. Upstairs the teapot, downstairs the dungeon, in between moonlight pulled over song. 2182, through the keyhole, waft of cow's tongue, delusion tinkling on ice. The parakeet bangs his head against his little bell, hangs on the unforgiving hook. Up the sun-drenched block from 2182, Oshi finds comfort hugging concrete, chanting safety over ants. Walking home, the windows of Greenwich Street flare. With one hand, she catches a dove, breathes it back to flight. With the other, turns the sizzling knob.
My goodness. This Xi series is my favorite in the book, I think, and it's absolutely afraid of nothing. And when readers come across poems like this, I find at least that they can often be maudlin or so raw as to just make the reader turn away and just, oh, my goodness, I can't handle this. It's too much. Mm-hmm. And all the poetry is lost in the rawness. But in this, and without asking about the whether or not this is autobiographical, et cetera, I have to say that it's not a poem that one turns away from, but is pulled into and pulled into again and again in its difficulty. And
Thank you.
I just really admire this poem, I have to say that. When will the book be available, or is it already?
It is already mm-hmm. available. It's available on Amazon. There are some copies at Copperfields in Santa Rosa. In the Montgomery Village store.
Uh-huh.
And it's also available directly from the press, Bite and Dival.
Okay. Catherine, thank you so much for appearing on your show. And I'm glad that this conspiracy occurred. And it's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it.
Thank you so much, Jerry.
You're welcome.
And it's a wrap. Thanks to Alicia Ostricker and Jerry Fleming. If you'd like to hear this program again on the archives, you can go to krcb.org/wordtemple. If you would like to know about live events coming up at the Word Temple Poetry Series, go to wordtemple.com. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's program, contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.